This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
We're here today with Dr. Martin Bureau from Oxford University. Welcome to the Jodcast again.
Thank you.
So you were on the Jodcast last in August 2007, which is way before we were on the Jodcast, so you're an old hand at this. Today you've been in Manchester talking about molecular gas in early type galaxies in the local universe. So before we get onto that, could we just talk a little bit about the conventional understanding of galaxies? What do most people think of when we talk about galaxies?
Yes, absolutely. And it's good to be back on the podcast. I guess usually, you know, galaxies are essentially classified by the way they appear visually. And usually they come in two big categories that are called late types and the early types, which is what I was referring to in the title of my talk. But perhaps some of your listeners are familiar with what's called the Hubble sequence, which is essentially just arranging the galaxies again visually or morphologically by their simple appearance and their shapes. And the late types corresponds to what people know as the spiral galaxies, and their disk galaxies, which means that they're flat and they look very much like an old record. So they're flattened because the stars and the gas rotate rapidly, just like the solar system, in fact. And so these are the late type galaxies. Now the early type galaxies correspond to the elliptical galaxies that, just as the name implies, have an elliptical shape. So they're round-ish, right? A little bit flattened, but not totally flat like an old record. So they really look a little bit like a balloon. And in fact, the reason they have this shape is exactly the same reason why balloons have the shape they have, is that the stars are supported by the pressure. Essentially, the stars move in all kinds of different directions, just like the atoms of gas in a balloon. And so we have the late types and the early types corresponding to the spiral galaxies and the elliptical galaxies.
So I sometimes get a bit confused when we talk about early and late type. So early type galaxies are the kind of galaxies you found in the early universe a long time ago, and the late ones are the ones you find closer to us.
Not necessarily, actually. So in fact, the word, you know, early type versus late type is totally wrong. I think originally it was thought that morphologically the galaxies should evolve essentially from being ellipticals, and therefore early, the first ones to appear, towards being spirals. But now we know, in fact, that if there is evolution, it's in the opposite direction, so that you start with the late-type galaxies, with the spirals, that are not very massive, and that as galaxies evolve, they evolve both for so dynamical reasons, so kind of a bit like a, I guess the analogy would be, you know, crowd dynamics. You know, when you have a lot of people together, they tend to behave differently than when they're alone. It's the same thing for stars. You have instabilities that develop, and the galaxies can change their shape internally, and they will tend, spiral galaxies would tend to become elliptical. And equally, if two spiral galaxies merge together, so you take two small things and you crash them together, they will form an elliptical galaxy and therefore an early type. So we think, in fact, that generally in the universe, that's the way that most galaxies evolve, is by merging to form larger galaxies. And so galaxies would go from being late types, i.e. spiral galaxies, to early types, the elliptical galaxies. So the use of early type and late type now is purely for historical reasons. We know that largely it's meaningless, really.
And so your talk then was on local early type galaxies. So could you explain what these galaxies are?
Yeah, absolutely. So local first is because they're nearby, right? So they're not very far away. Obviously far by, you know, terrestrial standards, but not very far by astronomical standards. So probably many of your listeners would be familiar with the Andromeda Galaxy, for example. That's obviously the closest giant galaxy to us, a galaxy that's very similar to our Milky Way. The galaxies I was talking about would be anywhere from a few times the distance of Andromeda to a bit less than 100 times the distance. So by astronomical standards, it's really quite close. It's our galactic neighborhood, or extragalactic neighborhood.
All these galaxies are in our local supergroup then?
Absolutely, yeah, that's right. The local supercluster. And so that was the local. And then the early types is because I was mostly looking at elliptical galaxies, and also the transition between elliptical and spirals that we call lenticulars. But, you know, we don't really need to go into that distinction now.
And early-type galaxies are commonly referred to being red and dead. Can you tell me a bit what that means?
Yeah, that's right. That's a very common expression. So as you know, red is a color, right? And color traces temperature. So red is cool, right? That's a bit contrary to our usual experience on Earth, where we associate, you know, blue with being cold because of ice and red of being warm because of fire. But of course, in physics, it's the opposite. And, you know, as you know, if you look at the candle, actually the warmest part, which is the part near the thread, is actually blue, right? So, early type galaxies are said to be red and dead. The red bit means that the stars are cool and therefore probably very old. All the hot stars are already dead because they tend to be very massive and have very short lifetime. When I give public talks, I often say that these very massive stars are rock stars, not because they're made out of rock, but because they essentially live very shortly and go out with a big bang, essentially. and so elliptical galaxies are red and dead. They're red because they're old, and they're dead because they're not currently forming stars. And so star formation, so the birth of new stars, is generally thought to be over, essentially, in these galaxies. So they're not really creating new generations of stars. That's very different, for example, in the Milky Way, where we know that in the spiral arms, we see a lot of these blobs of star formations. And so these galaxies, spiral galaxies, are much bluer. So, yeah, in summary, ellipticals are red and dead because they're old and not forming new stars.
But you found molecular gas in these galaxies that you're looking at. So does that contradict what we know about these galaxies?
Possibly, and that's a little bit the whole point of the exercise of you know, essentially trying to answer those questions. So by molecular gas, first I should say that obviously it's gas that's formed by molecule as opposed to atomic species. For example, the most important molecule we think exists in the universe is molecular hydrogen. So two hydrogen atoms attached together. Hydrogen is, of course, the most abundant element in the universe. So it's natural that molecular hydrogen would be the most common molecule. But it turns out that molecular hydrogen is very hard to observe because it's very hard to excite that molecule and make it emit light. So what we use to observe it is actually carbon monoxide, so the CO, just like we find a lot in the Earth atmosphere. And so the reason I studied molecular gas is because molecules tend to form only when the gas is very dense, i.e. there's a lot of molecules or atoms to start with close together. So if the gas is tenuous, is not very dense, the atoms will happily stay separate. But if you push them close enough together, they will bind and form molecules. And so we know that stars are born essentially where the gas is very dense, where gravity is very strong. And so we think that stars are born in molecular gas as opposed to atomic gas, which would be much more tenuous. And so as you were implying there, it's a bit surprising. Well, essentially, maybe I can rephrase. If you have molecular gas, you would expect to have star formation because that means you have very dense gas. And so we usually talk of molecular gas as being the fuel reservoir for star formation. And so the question in these early types, red and dead galaxies, was, you know, if they're not forming stars, presumably we shouldn't expect them to have molecular gas. But when we did look, we found a lot of it, which was quite surprising.
How did you look to trace this molecular gas in these early type elliptical galaxies?
Yeah, well, we look with telescopes, but with a particular kind of telescopes, it turns out, you know, based on basic physics, that molecules, the light we see comes from essentially what we call vibrational modes. So when a molecule vibrates, essentially it emits light at specific frequencies, and those frequencies happen to be in the hundreds of gigahertz regime, which maybe it's easier to understand talking of wavelengths, which would be here a few millimeters. So essentially, these molecules vibrate at the same frequencies that your microwave oven does. And that's not surprising because a microwave is made to cook water. And water is a basic molecule, not unlike CO. It has vibrational modes, so it emits light in very similar frequencies. So in fact, we're observing frequencies or wavelengths that are very similar to that used in a microwave oven. And the way we do that is use telescopes that are specifically designed to detect these wavelengths. So most listeners are probably familiar with optical telescope that just like a telescope you could buy at the corner shop, but much bigger, of course, for astronomers. And with radio telescopes, such as the one here at Jodrell Bank Observatory. Millimeter telescope is somewhere in between. They use a technology that's very similar to radio telescopes, so they look like satellite dishes. But because the wavelength is only a few millimeters, the surface of the telescope has to be very good, right? It has to be polished quite accurately, obviously, to a fraction of the wavelength. So much better than a millimeter. So you need to have this shape, this paraboloid shape, to be very accurate. And the detectors are fairly similar to the ones used in radio telescopes. So essentially the basic millimeter telescope would look like a rather big satellite dish, but generally much smaller than the large radio telescopes that people are used to see.
So you look at these galaxies and you see molecular gas. Do you also see stars? Do you see this evidence for star formation there?
Well, we see old stars. I mean, that's how these galaxies were identified to start with. You know, that's how they were put in the Hubble sequence and why we labeled them as early type or ellipticals. Then when we look with those millimeter telescopes to look for carbon monoxide, so CO, in order to trace this molecular hydrogen that we think is very abundant, we find that about a quarter, roughly, of these early type galaxies have a substantial molecular gas reservoir. And by substantial, I mean they're something of order 10 to 100 to occasionally a billion times the mass of the sun worth of molecular hydrogen. And so these are obviously huge numbers. Compared to the total mass of these elliptical galaxies, however, it's not that large. The stellar mass, so the mass in stars in these galaxies, would be typically about 100 times larger. So only about 1% of the mass of these galaxies is constituted by molecular hydrogen. Nevertheless, it was surprising because in most of them, we don't see any new stars. Now, the question is, how hard do you look? You know, and so if we look a bit harder, we do find that some of them have new stars. And then the question is, you know, given, you know, X amount of molecular hydrogen, do you get the right amount predicted of young stars? And in many of those, we think we don't find enough, which suggests that the way that stars are forming might be different than in spiral galaxies, for example, where these processes are fairly well understood.
Just for comparison to our own spiral galaxy, the Milky Way, how much molecular gas would be in our galaxy compared to the elliptical galaxies that you're measuring?
Yeah, so if memory is good, it's about a billion times the mass of the sun in molecular hydrogen in the Milky Way, in fact, a few times this. So our best detections, if you want, the most exciting galaxies we detected, the ellipticals, would have about the same amount. But of course, in a relative manner, that's much less because the mass in stars in elliptical galaxies is much larger than that in the Milky Way, by at least a factor of 10, sometimes more. And our typical detection, so the average elliptical, would have probably 10 times less molecular hydrogen than the Milky Way. So, you know, 10 times less molecular hydrogen for 10 times more stars means that as a ratio, they have 100 times less. So per unit mass, they would have 100 times less molecular hydrogen.
Can I just go back a step? So we were talking about detecting carbon monoxide, but then talking about mass of molecular hydrogen. So is there a relationship between the carbon monoxide and the hydrogen that you get the mass from the carbon monoxide?
Yes.
Or is that too complicated?
Well, it's, I'm not sure complicated is the right word, but it's certainly hotly debated. So indeed, the idea is that for, you know, every, let's say, molecular hydrogen molecule, so you have X number of carbon monoxide. Now, as I mentioned before, hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. Then you have, of course, lots of helium and so on. And carbon and oxygen is mostly processed into stars, right? So clearly you need to have had stars to generate these so-called metals, is what astronomers call them, anything more massive than helium. But anyway, these heavy elements. And so we know essentially how many carbon monoxide molecule we have per hydrogen or molecular hydrogen molecule in the Milky Way. So we can determine this fairly well based on a fairly long chain of arguments that I don't really want to get into. And in fact, some parts are a bit nebulous to me, in fact. But the point is that we know that number in the Milky Way, and then we just assume that the same is true in other galaxies. And that, of course, is a huge assumption, which is almost certainly wrong. But the whole question is, how wrong? You know, are you a factor of 2 off, or you're a factor of 100 off? And we're pretty sure we're not a factor of 100, but we could be a factor of a few. So in fact, when I've talked about these masses, the implicit assumption I was making is that the so-called conversion factor, you know, as good astronomers call it, the X factor. So the X factor is called the conversion factor, X because we don't have a clue what it is really. We assume it's in the same as the Milky Way. So if it were different, the numbers I just mentioned would be different as well. It's quite a large conversion. So for every molecular hydrogen atom, we think there's of order, if memory is good, is 10 to the 20. Sorry, other way around. For every CO atom, there's 10 to the 20, roughly, molecular hydrogen. It's a bit more complicated than that kind of order of magnitude. And so you can see that if we're off, we could be off by quite a lot.
In these elliptical galaxies, you've detected the molecular gas. Do all of them have star formation occurring in them as well?
No, and that's the surprising bit. So some of them do. When some of them, star formation proceeds in the way we expect based on our preconceived ideas, if you want, on spiral galaxies, on galaxies like the Milky Way. And so some of them do seem to follow that these preconceptions. You know, everything seems to be normal. But in a few of them, there are indications that this is not the case. Now, you know, as I said, it always depends how hard you look. And of course, the problem is when you see that things might not be normal, you look harder, right? And so when you look harder and you try to quantify some of these numbers better, you see that the differences may not be hugely different, but there's definitely some correlations between different quantities. So, you know, a bit like this conversion factor, if you want, that we think are a bit different. This is a law that's called the Schmidt-Kennicott law, which is obviously based on some work by Schmidt and other work by Kennicott, as one might expect. That tells you essentially how much star formation you would expect given a certain amount of molecular hydrogen or of gas, more generally. And that correlation is very tight, meaning spiral galaxies seem to follow this empirical law very well. I say empirical because it's just observed, right? So we take a spiral galaxy, we check in a given area how much star formation there is, we check how much molecular gas there is, and we plot them X versus Y on a plot, and we repeat the exercise, and all spiral galaxies seem to follow the same line. So the question then for ellipticals is, if you take a unit area, you measure how much star formation there is, you take a unit area, you check how much gas there is, do they follow the same line or not? And at the moment, actually, the surprising answer is yes. But the error bars, so the uncertainties we have on our points, is actually quite large. And so that's not a partially meaningful statement at this point. But there are other indications that we have that things are not totally normal. In a bit slight astronomer jargon, there's a thing called the Farnfred radio correlation, which again is plotting on one axis the radio flux, so what you detect with the radio telescope, and on the y-axis, the infrared flux. And again, usually galaxies follow a tight correlation there, and we're sure that the early type galaxies, the so-called red and dead galaxies, don't. They are much, don't have enough radio or too much infrared, depending on how you see things. Now, that may not sound very exciting for maybe your average listener, but for astronomers, when you know that thousands of galaxies follow these relations very precisely, and then you find a few that systematically don't, that not only tells you that they're different, but you might actually be able to probe different physics by looking at this specific subset of objects.
Again, I seem to keep on taking steps back. Where does this gas actually come from? Is it generated inside the galaxy, or does it come from somewhere else?
Okay, well, very good question. that's another question we've been trying to answer. Essentially, as you've mentioned, there are different possibilities for where the gas might come from. The obvious one is that as stars evolve and die, they return a large fraction of their mass to the so-called interstellar medium, so essentially to the space around them, right? And the obvious example of that are planetary nebulae, right? Your listeners are probably familiar with those. The reason they look so nice is because the outer layers of the stars have been ejected, right? And they form these nice ring-like structures that are just essentially a sphere seen in projection on the sky. So this is a process by which many stars return their mass. Of course, the more massive stars that live more shortly would return their mass through a supernova explosion, so an even more violent event. But certainly most stars would return a large fraction of their mass over their lifetime. And so this gas is returned to the galaxy, right? Gravity will pull it together, and you can have new generations of stars born of that gas. Now, the particularity of the gas that is accumulated this way is that the gas will move the same way as the parent stars do. And so, for example, in terms of rotation, if you think about the spiral galaxies, the stars are going around. So when they lose gas or when they return gas to the galaxy, this gas will be moving around in the same way. Another possibility is for the gas to come from outside the galaxies to be accreted, we say. And it may be just like gas more or less raining down on the galaxy slowly from a reservoir that is currently unseen, but some people think it's there. And another, in my view, more likely possibility is that you could have smaller galaxies falling in And small galaxies are usually very gas-rich. That is, the ratio of gas to stars is much larger in these galaxies. And we know that this happens. The Milky Way, for example, if you go in the southern hemisphere, you can see, right, the so-called Magellanic Clouds with the naked eye. And these are satellite galaxies to our own, just like the moon orbits around the Earth. And so these two galaxies are in a process of slowly falling and being gobbled up by our own Milky Way. And so, essentially, if the same process happens on these red and dead galaxies, then you have a way to regenerate them. Right? A small galaxy falls in, it brings in a lot of gas, and then this gas can form new stars. Now, as I've just implied, by the way, I said this gas would be accreted. This gas would not be rotating like the stars that are in the original galaxy, right? If you think about the Magellanic Clouds, they're arriving at some angle on the Milky Way and will not be rotating like the Sun. So the same process can happen in these early type galaxies. And the key to diagnose, essentially, where the gas is coming from is to look at whether it behaves, right, whether it moves like the stars of the parent galaxy. And that's a test that we've been trying to make in these, in our own sample of elliptical galaxy.
I have a question. If the early type galaxies are full of evolved stars and these emit the molecular gas, how come we don't see much more molecular gas in these galaxies than what we do see?
That's a very good question, and I'm afraid I don't have the answer. So that's been a big mystery, in fact, since 30 years. As you said, we would expect that there would be lots of gas in early type galaxies just because stars continuously lose mass, right? Stars evolve, go in this planetary nebula stage, and return all of their mass to the interstellar medium. The generally accepted solution is that this gas does not cool, meaning it doesn't become cold and very dense. It stays rather tenuous and hot. And that means it wouldn't form molecules. It would remain in an atomic form. It would most likely become highly ionized, right? So it's so energetic that the electrons around the atoms are kicked out, essentially. If this gas would reach temperatures of about 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin, so or 1,000,000 Celsius, if you want, we could detect it with so-called X-ray telescopes that are orbiting in space. If it's of order 10 to the 4 or less, then it would become cool enough that we could detect it through normal optical telescopes, or if it's become very cold, through the molecular gas, for example. But there is one temperature range which we're not very sensitive to, and that's roughly around 100,000 Kelvin. And we just don't have very good instrumentation to detect this gas. And its surface brightness, so its brightness on the sky, if you want, is quite low. That is very difficult to detect. So you can hide this gas around this temperature. So if the gas that the stars lose is, for a reason or another, reaches a temperature of about 10 to the 5 Kelvin, or a few times this, then it would be very difficult indeed to detect it. And so therefore, for astronomers, that's a good place to hide it at the moment.
So you mentioned before that there's this theory that maybe spiral galaxies turn into elliptical galaxies. Does the detection of molecular gas in these early type galaxies, does that change what we think about galaxy evolution?
Not so much that basic underlying paradigm. The kind of technical word is the hierarchical structure formation paradigm. And of course, hierarchical means exactly what it's meant to say, which is that it's hierarchical. So small things merge together to make bigger things, right? Small blobs merge and make bigger blobs. And at some point, it's big enough that you call it a galaxy. I think that paradigm or that idea is still probably generally right. I suspect that the phenomenon that we're seeing is a fairly late one in the evolution of the universe, so that this big merging, right, these big blobs merging together to make even bigger blobs, that occurred mostly fairly early on in the life of the universe, in the few billion years at the beginning. These days, the universe is a much more quiet place. And so I think what we're seeing, often we say it's a sprinkling of young stars. So you have essentially your red and dead galaxy, and you just sprinkle on top of it a little bit of gas. As I said, it's 4% or less. And then even if you were to turn this into stars, you're just changing the mass of the galaxy by about 1%, right? So you're not going to suddenly make an entirely new galaxy that looks different. So we're talking about a much more subtle mechanism. But having said that, it may well be the dominant mechanism today, that is quite late in the evolution of the universe, when this intense period of merging has largely ended.
Thank you, Martin, for joining us on the Jodcast again. It's been great to interview and catch up on your research.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.